Welcome to School's Out with Mike and Miles. Real talk about education for teachers and everyone who loves learning.
Hey, Miles.
Hey, Mike.
Back at it.
We're here.
What are we talking about this week? I think we're on a help series, aren't we?
Yeah, and the next one we're going to do is Help My Students Aren't Learning.
Oh, my. So I think we should probably define we should set some boundaries for this. You know, right out the gate, I think we should say, like, what learning looks like in different arenas in education. So in my mind, I'm thinking my kids aren't learning in front of me right now. My kids aren't learning by the end of the week. My kids aren't learning by the end of the unit, or my kids aren't learning by the end of the year. Maybe we could just lay it out like that and kind of address each one of those issues individually, then maybe all together with some universal design.
Right. And I think that teachers that we talk with feel frustrations in all of those ways, right? They feel frustration. I taught this lesson and it doesn't seem like it landed like my students learned. You know, I taught this unit on this and not enough of my students learned throughout that unit. District gave this benchmark assessment and my data doesn't look the way I want it to look. Or at the end of the year, most states have a state standardized test. My data doesn't look the way I want it to look there. There's all those different levels of frustration, I think, that teachers, educators can feel within this.
And I think we should start out by saying, too, that we have to make at least one assumption about the classroom atmosphere. So based on our last episode of Help My Kids Are Out of Control or Help My Kids Won't Behave or whatever that is, we have to make an assumption that certain behaviors have been practiced, rehearsed, demonstrated, that there is consistency among behaviors in the classroom. Even with strong behaviors, that those things have been worked out, that at least a teacher and all of the students can have open communication, free of distraction, free of those types of things that would interfere with learning. We should probably make that assumption. If that's going to be something that people rest on, then I would say go back to the last episode where we addressed that head on. I think another thing that we should state, and Miles, I don't think you're going to disagree with me on this, that as far as planning is concerned, aligning instruction and planning to what's expected of us from our higher agencies is an absolute must. And I'm going to let you talk on that a little bit about designing instruction based on those principles.
Right. And we've talked, Mike, about this topic. You're in education and you've come to the place, Help My Students Aren't Learning. We need to be able to clearly define what it is they're supposed to learn. Most likely, the state where you teach has defined that, helped you to define that, set that really clearly for your grade level, for your subject area. This is what your students are supposed to learn. And then we need to, I think, in a really purposeful way, work backwards from that. You know that eligible content is going to be assessed in some way at the end of the year. And then take one step all the way back and work backwards rather than work forwards. You know, this is the eligible content. Here's the assessment at the end of the year. These are the incremental steps that I'm going to take every day along the way to make sure that my students have mastered all of these skills and all of this content to be successful out here.
And I think that it's important, too, that even great teachers, they align every single lesson toward those goals. Even if it's a reward lesson, the students are able to demonstrate that they're getting a reward based on performance toward that same goal. That every lesson, I think you mentioned this prior to us coming on, every lesson is pointed at that goal. And then the goals, the unit goals are directly aligned to that end of year goal. Our lesson goals are directly aligned to our unit goals, which are also pointed at that end of year goal. That planning is backward, but every single lesson, and it really hit me hard when you said this, if you have 170 lessons per se, every single one of those is pointed at the goal. Every one. Because if you think about it that way, you don't have many opportunities to get where you need to go. You've got to really capitalize your time. And so that planning with that end in mind is essential. We can't just walk in and say, I think I'm doing it right. No. That long-term planning, short-term planning is essential, that it be aligned.
And if you think about it that way, and then you get down to the really granular lesson by lesson view of this, then you can take a look at, I taught this lesson on this topic, provided this experience for my kids. They didn't learn this. Then what do I need to do? I'm in a help situation. And I know that that's kind of who we're talking to, that audience right now, a really small perspective on this lesson. But if I know as the teacher, this lesson builds on this concept and relates to this bigger idea, and then is going to be assessed way out here on this assessment. And that, I hope everyone knows by now, that's not the be all and end all of what we do, but I can pinpoint and know my kids need to have mastered this to get here to be really successful out on this big assessment. And then I can make some changes in real time or day by day to really help to fix this problem.
I'm gonna focus in on one of the things that you said in that. When we start talking about the kids and how they're performing, and you said like they aren't, I really want to focus in on who they are. As a teacher, as an instructor, as somebody planning these lessons, I don't want any teacher to feel that because they see a glimpse of some students struggling, that they assume all students are struggling. It is very important in my world that we say exactly who isn't learning, and we start counting how many they are, but put names to them as well. Because if I know that Tim is struggling to learn, then Tim now with me has a separate goal that is based on the unit, that's based on the end of the year. And it might look a little bit different in this lesson to catch Tim up to right now. Mm-hmm. So those we would call interventions, but we want to make sure that we have them in place to help Tim now, to help him this week by the end of the school year. Before we get too deep into those things, you know, looking at some of that data, I think that really, really good teachers are going to be curious. They have to say, I wonder what's going on. So I would say that as we move through this and we start looking at things that we can do in a lesson, things that we can do in a unit and by the end of the year, the number one thing that should drive this is curiosity. And because it's a safe way of saying you're not going to lose your job if you're trying to help kids. So if you are curious and exploring different things to help kids learn now and by the end of the year, you're doing okay. You're in the right spot, but I'm certainly glad you're listening, because that's where I'm coming from. That space of curiosity, that space of saying, I'm going to try to make change for each and every one of my kids, but focus on who they are. And then we can start to figure out ways to make change, because it might be person specific. We might have to engage them for their interests. I know we talked about that just a little bit.
Yeah. And I think right now we can kind of get through the idea of the topic and get some real things to teachers out there that are listening to this, educators, my students aren't learning. The first thing I want to address, or I think the starting place, is what aren't they learning? And you just said it, Mike, who are they? What aren't they learning, and who is not learning that, right?
So let's look at it from a lesson perspective. Okay, so we're going to start a lesson. And Miles, you talk about the 5 minutes at the beginning of the lesson. So I'd say even before that 5 minutes, we're going to talk about the hook here in a second, but even before that 5 minutes, let's just say that great teachers are going to have a couple things done. We're going to talk about knowing that your kids understand what you're about to teach. So there is a reason why we talk about objectives, and there's a reason why in my world, I start to say, like, defend your instruction so that kids can defend their learning. That starts with, what am I supposed to learn? Why am I here? So your objective, I think you were talking about in your school, your objective is on the board. And the steps that we're going to go to reach that are right underneath it.
I want it to be really clearly defined in every educational space, whether I'm trying to teach this lesson right now to people out there or whatever else. Like, my objective for this podcast, what is it? Help my students aren't learning. The objective, by the end of this podcast, everyone listening will be able to concretely take steps to help their students learn if they are not, right? If I can't write that sentence, then I shouldn't start the lesson. That's the foundation of the lesson, right? And everybody going through a teacher education program, if you went through a similar experience that I did, you learned how to write those really clear learning objectives. It looks to me like a lot of people, we like kind of drift away from that at some point in lesson preparation and instruction and those things. A clear, concrete, measurable goal. You know, when they taught you how to write that, at the end of this lesson, all students will be able to fill in the blank concretely. And like teachers I talk to or people I work with, I think that goal becomes really way, way, way too vague, right? Or they don't write that goal sentence in the beginning. So if we're looking at this, help my students aren't learning, what aren't they learning? Go back to the lesson, right? At the end of this lesson, all students will be able to write the capital A perfectly, right? Go like, I don't know what that is, like kindergarten, first grade, out of here. Where I see my kids doing that, Mike, right? Like, that's the objective. I want them all to make the capital letter A perfectly. That is the clear objective. I can measure that at the end of that lesson. Mm-hmm. The evidence is a perfectly written capital letter A. Now I know, help my students aren't learning. Four of my 10 kids didn't do that. What did I do? You're going to talk about this, Mike. What did I do during that lesson then to assist in that? But if I get the end of my 40-minute capital A lesson and they didn't learn that, now what?
Yeah, so I can't stress enough what you said about all students will be able to, because classically in our instruction on being a teacher at teacher school or whatever, you know, we all learned that the students will be able to. And I want to focus on something that we did not learn. We did not learn to write that by saying some students will be able to.
Yes.
That never, ever has approached nor been written by any teacher on any lesson plan in the history of the world. No teacher has ever written 40% of my students will be able to. No. No, everybody says students will be able to. And I'm assuming that's all students. So with that in mind, I'm teaching a lesson. I see that two or three students aren't learning it. They're struggling. And I can tell that because I am not blindly, or I don't mean the term blindly, but I am not just going through the motions of this lesson without seeing how my students are doing. And I vision myself as a chef making some soup when I'm doing this. As I'm building this soup, I have to constantly taste it to see if it's going to be what I want. So I've got to do that with my students. I have to have a hand on the pulse of how they're taking in what we're doing. And in order to do that, as soon as I notice that a couple of kids aren't following along or aren't getting what I'm trying to have them get, I need full pockets. I, as a teacher, need full pockets of things that I can present to a class that gives me an opportunity to let them practice what I just talked about so that I can bring these other two students up to right now. That's a quick intervention. But if I don't have full pockets, I'm going to become complacent and say, I'm moving through this lesson anyway, and I'm leaving these two kids behind, and I'll catch up to them later. Later's not good enough for me. Later is not good enough for me because later is a missed opportunity. So I'm going to pull something out of my pocket that I'm going to say, I'm going to have everybody practice this, and you two are going to come practice this with me. And that practice might be different, but it's to catch them up to right now. Now, is that going to work? It's going to work for me right now because I said all students will be able to. Now, they're going to be able to right now because I'm not leaving them go. This is not an option. Now, by the end of the week, we can talk just really briefly. If they still don't know it, guess what? I know every lesson I've brought them up to right now. Maybe I can do a different intervention, something at a later time, but I'm not letting them go right now. So when I say a teacher needs full pockets, I really mean that. There's a lot of extra planning. There's a lot of that heart of a teacher that goes into saying, I'm okay to stop this scripted lesson. Put something out there now as a practice to bring these two or three or five or six. But if that number gets too big, I think there's that 80-20% that teacher world talks about. If that number gets too big of kids that don't understand, you're reteaching the whole lesson. You're stopping the whole lesson and redesigning it. But you have to do that for just two or three also.
And I purposely used the idea of writing the capital letter A perfectly as a skill-based thing to illustrate this. I'm teaching 10 kids to write the perfect capital letter A. By the end of this 40 minutes, everyone in this room will be able to do that. I can observe that. I can assess that as the teacher. What a lot of times we do is we assess it sometimes, and then we say, 4 out of 10 didn't do it, and we move on to B, right? That's what happens.
Yeah.
So then we get frustrated students and teachers by the time we get to the end of the alphabet and 30% of the kids can't master the, like you said, Mike, I've got to master, everybody in this room has to master this in 45 minutes. What happens a lot of times and builds frustration for teachers is we instantly, and I don't want to make teachers mad, but I want you to think about this. We instantly start to make excuses why they can't, mm-hmm. right? Joey has a cast on his right hand. He can't write. Like Miles, he's not going to be able to make the perfect capital letter A. Okay. What if everyone in this room's life were on, not to get dramatic, what if your life were on the line for him to write the perfect capital letter A? Mm-hmm. Could we, what accommodations are we going to have to creatively think of in this space to make that happen? Less dramatically, this kid over here doesn't have the fine motor skills coming in. They're not developed yet to manage his pencil. He doesn't hold his pencil right. What do I need to do before, during, and after to make sure everybody can write the perfect capital letter A?
And I'm going to up the ante in this conversation, and I'm going to say that in a real life scenario, because I'm ready for skeptics to say, well, hold on, that doesn't sound real. Let me give a couple of real examples too to add into this. Guess what? Sam already knows how to write the perfect letter A. So Sam doesn't want to do this lesson. Well, guess what? I might accommodate for that, and I might allow him to either write the perfect letter cursive A, or I might allow him to write the perfect Arabic A because he already knows how to make the perfect A in this lesson. Or maybe I have Susie over here who does not want to do this because she finds no relevance in writing the capital letter A. That's going to go right back to, here's my objective, here's how we're going to do it, and now here's my hook to the whole class. Guess what we're doing today? We are going to practice, and we're going to sell this hook to everybody and create a desire to want to do this. But I'm also going to have accommodations for those at the top and those at the bottom and those in the middle. And I'm using these terms loosely, and I apologize to anybody who might seem hurt by these terms. But at the same time, I'm being real about it. Nobody gets left out. Nobody. And that's me being a teacher who's saying, when I write the objective, the students will be able to write the perfect letter A. That's all students, not some.
All. And the two of us, Mike, have been working on a really tight lesson plan format that I think that we're going to have ready to give to teachers and that they can use. But that format starts with the what, which is the objective, concrete. They can do this or they can't. Binary. Mm-hmm. They can write a perfect capital letter A or they can't. And then the next step is the why. And that's delivered in the first 5 minutes of this lesson too. Essential. This is what you're going to do. This is why it matters to you, to all 10 kids in this class that are learning to write the perfect capital letter A. And then I don't want to get too wacky here, but it's in anything, any literature you want to look at, classroom culture and building a community of learners. All 10 people in this space are going to be able to do this. And all 10 of you know that's our objective. We are not leaving this lesson until we can do that. Now, what's that look like? The kid who's already mastered that coming in, he knows that the success of this collective group is dependent on that kid over there being able to make the perfect capital letter A too. What then, what kind of ownership can that kid who's already mastered it take to help that student? What then is everybody collectively going to do in this time together to make sure we can all do that?
Right.
I'm so invested in that. You sold me on why, because it's important for blah, 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 blah. Now we're all going to do that. Not 9 out of 10 of us, all of us.
And when we keep that idea that all of us are going to do it and that we can all express why, that why is in defense of what the state or our institution or agency is holding us to do. The why can be expressed in everyone's own terms. The state has its own terms in the form of a standard or a progression in the state of Pennsylvania. But now if you start putting those terms in student words, they're defending their own learning. They're telling why it's important that they do this. Now you've got them bought in. Students have ownership of their learning. They're able to express how what they're doing is relevant to what they're being tasked to do by a higher agency in their own words. That is critical in my world, in our world, to say, this is why I'm doing it. I'm vested in this.
And you've called that, Mike, when we talked, you know, defending your learning as a student, being able to have discourse on your learning, the purpose of it, the why, and that can be collectively created and stated for a group of learners. This capital letter A is about as basic as it gets in that, but we need to be able to say this is the why together, and it's not just me as the teacher in my first 5 minutes telling you. I want to have discourse on that. I want to encourage you as six-year-olds to think about why making a perfect capital letter A matters to you. And if you're in the back of the room saying, this is dumb, I don't want to do this, I want to hear from you. I want to engage on that because my objective going in is to get everybody to do this perfectly. So I'm going to have to answer that why for you.
And really, I don't want to leave out that kid in the back of the room because I think a teacher with this curiosity has to always think too. This is probably a separate podcast episode, but I don't want to do this, but I know I have to because I'm using the word we as my class. We need to do this. I don't always have to like it, but if I own it as a collective, I could also own it as an individual. Because if my classroom culture is just that, a culture, and it's a we, I might not want to make this capital A, but I know that we need to. And there's something in it for us if we do. That's a whole separate episode. This idea of perhaps rewarding a classroom, but I'd say celebrating our success. We made it. We're all in this boat, and we're rowing to a destination, and we all made it to the destination. Enjoy your R&R. But here's the thing. Tell me why we're on R&R. Tell me why we're celebrating right now. Now I haven't wasted a lesson. We're celebrating and you're telling me why. I win, you win, we all win.
And I also don't want to make this too big because I want to stay really practical for people. But why aren't my students learning? I think it's essential that we get to the why, but I also think it's essential that we attach bigger, real things to the learning. So even in this class where I'm teaching to write the capital, perfect capital letter A, I have already front-loaded this with telling my students that once we're able to write all of the perfect capital letters, each kid in this space is going to have two or three letters assigned to them. And we're going to make these awesome poster drawings of the letter people. And we're going to have those up and we're going to teach next year's class what those letters. And I've got this bigger purpose. And you can't not make the perfect capital because you're doing A, man. Like you're doing A for the group. And that's one of the reasons. And then I can get to the bigger purpose for the kids, you know, life trajectory right. Later also. But the last thing I want to say about just this quick lesson idea is that we have formative assessments, the fancy term for in the moment assessment of learning. A lot of times those things are called exit tickets, right? And I want to flip the script on the exit ticket idea a little bit. To me, an exit ticket is I give you this, I get to leave, right? And I give you this on the way out the door, the way out of the lesson. Okay, I get to leave. We don't use those in the right way. I need to give you my perfect capital letter A. Okay, here you go. It wasn't perfect, but I'm leaving anyways. You're not leaving the space. We are not this group of 10 moving on until everyone has the perfect capital A. That's when you give me the exit ticket.
Right.
You don't exit until it's perfect. Because like you said, Mike, if we go to tomorrow and that A isn't perfect, what is B going to look like?
Right. Right. Because now I'm struggling with A and I'm learning B now too. And I think as educators, we have to get out of that circle of thought. We have to stop saying, well, we got to move on. And if you didn't get it, then you what? That's not a you statement. That to me, you know, if you didn't get it, then I need to do something for you. And I know that's hard to hear for some people. And some people, even in conversations that I've had, will say, that's not realistic, Mike. That's not realistic. Not all kids are going to move along at the same, and I will agree, they're not all going to move along at the same pace, but they must all master A before we move on to B.
And that the word we're using in the objective statement, all. It's not some, it's not a few, it's not depending on where they're coming to me, it's all.
Right.
And if you look at the lesson that way, all binary, you did it or you didn't. My job is to get 100% for this group. That's it.
And if you look at it that way in that binary terms, yes or no, it's going to make your unit much more attainable for success. My kids aren't learning. Start with the lesson because to give the listeners some concrete things that they could do to affect change in their unit planning and lesson planning, let's move away from the lesson and let's look at like the end of the week or the end of 2 weeks. All right, I'm doing everything. I'm making these stop interventions in the now to bring children up to now. Okay, so maybe you're doing everything you can, but by the end of the week or the end of 2 weeks, you're noticing people aren't producing what you thought they would at an end of unit exam or an end of unit assessment. So I would suggest a couple things in this case. One, as a professional educator, what are your colleagues doing in the same space with that unit? Because it seems you're doing some great things. What are everybody else doing? Satisfy that curiosity, gain some insight from other educators as to what activities they're doing and how they're getting through to kids. Maybe their hook's a little bit different. maybe some of the activities that they're doing are a little bit different. You know, good intention goes so far, but now let's pair that with some good practice or a good hook or whatever. And in addition to that, maybe we start to look at how our learners are coming into this space and we start to gain insight into their culture. So maybe there's some skill deficiencies, for example, maybe the output in which they're showing their learning is maybe that skill needs to be developed. If the only way that I'm asking kids to demonstrate their learning is in writing, but most of the lessons were delivered verbally, I'm going to catch kids failing in that if they don't write well. So what if I were just talking about the letter A, but I never sat down and guided someone's hand to make that A? Because the only way that I'm going to know that you have mastered the letter A is by you writing it, but I've never actually guided your hand with mine to make an A. I've only shown you other people doing it. Those are things that I think really good teachers know, they see, but we often forget about in the teaching world, is that that output skill. So
if that is the perspective of the in real time, what this looks like for a lesson, then I think I want to move on, as long as we're good there, for what this looks like in a lesson, and say for a unit of learning. You know, these lessons build up to this idea of a unit, and I've already kind of talked about universal design and working backwards. And if I design a unit as a teacher, and I know all of the objectives, all of the standards that are going to be covered by the unit, and then my lessons individually align to that unit, and I get to the end of this unit, and I do my summative assessment, and it looks to me like my students haven't learned, and I feel that frustration, right? I put all of this time and effort into this. I created this assessment. It doesn't show evidence of the learning that I want to see. Now what? You know, that's what I want to work on with teachers too. What do we do next if we're in that situation? I'm killing myself creating these experiences, doing these lessons, doing the interventions. I get to the end of this unit and 50% of my kids are really struggling with this. What do I do?
I still say that in that particular scenario, if you're confident as a teacher that you've addressed those topics and kids were expressing to you knowledge on how to perform and how to show you their understanding, that by that level, by that end of unit level, there's got to be a skill deficiency, or there's got to be some kind of gap between the knowledge and the output. So whether it's a discomfort, whether it's a confidence factor, something in there is telling you that the children are, their output is not matching their input, if that makes sense. And we often see this, and I'm moving forward a little bit, but we're going to stay in the present. We often see this with those big state standardized tests. We know in our heart of hearts that we taught this. We know in our heart of hearts that we had really good assessments leading up to this standardized test, but boy, my kids just, they fumbled on it and they didn't produce at the end of it. It's probably because their output didn't match the input. And that could be a number of factors. It could be they didn't have the skill to produce the output, or they didn't have the desire to produce the output. And I'm heavy on that. I really am heavy on that. I mean, I talk about testing culture. I think that's a big part of it, or assessment culture.
And I'm going to go back to this central idea, kind of theme of things that I talk about. If the students have not learned, the teacher has not taught. Mm-hmm. If the students have not learned, the teacher has not taught.
And I would say that applies to skills as well as concepts.
Sure.
And I've heard this in high schools. I've heard this from colleagues, and I'm not taking digs at anybody, but I've actually even heard high school calculus teachers saying, my kids don't know their multiplication facts. And my response is, that sounds like a good place to start instruction. And that's the end of the conversation for me. Because if it's important for you as a teacher of a calculus class that your children know their multiplication facts and they're coming in not knowing it, that's not a reason to kick them out. That's a reason to teach. That's the essence of teaching. You don't know something that's important, and I do. I'm going to show you how to do this.
So let me get back to the unit summative assessment, right? Yeah. I give that 50% of my kids struggled with that assessment. Let me give you all the things not to do first. As you're saying, help my students did not learn. Do not curve the assessment. That's fake. We've talked about grades are fake. That is fake. Do not do that. Do not give an opportunity to do this other activity for bonus. That is fake. Do not do that. That is not going to improve the learning situation of that assessment. Do not curve the assessment. I made the 80% the 100 because that was the highest grade. No, that kid doesn't know 20% of what you assessed. Huge problem here. Huge problem. Do not give bonus opportunities to have someone do something else that is not proving their learning on this assessment. Don't do those things. And then the other things not to do, do not start to blame anybody else. Do not look for all of these reasons why. The kids don't care. They didn't try. They weren't. This kid was absent. Don't do those things, because there's only one place to place the blame. Hard to realize as a teacher that the blame is on you. I'm sorry if that hurts a little bit, but if we accept that ownership, then now what? And we're going to help to fill in the now what on this unit. Don't do those other things I just talked about, because they're going to be a dead end road. Your kids are never, you're always going to be struggling with this. Help, my kids aren't learning. Any of those avenues that I just talked about, they're dead ends.
Yeah. And I've used the analogy before where I can, well, it's your analogy. I just paired it with my own work experience. If teaching and learning were like teaching a kid how to cross the road, we're not going to say that like some kids are going to get across the road. No, all kids get across the road. And I'm saying if it's as emergent to teach a kid how to read as it is to teach them to cross the road, which I believe it is, then we approach teaching reading that way. It is emergent. It is non-negotiable. And I'm saying no matter what subject you teach, you as a listener are a paid professional. If you are teaching family consumer science, whatever you're teaching is as emergent as crossing the road. It is non-negotiable. All students will learn to this. It doesn't matter what the subject. You are there and they are there with you. You are sharing that learning space. This is for everyone. This is for every teacher. Non-negotiable.
Exactly. And I'm at the end of the unit. I'm the teacher. I gave the assessment. And let me just pivot from the capital letter A. And now my assessment was, I want my kids to write an outstanding descriptive paragraph, right? That's the assessment. And I see that 50% of my students weren't able to do that. First of all, I bet if you go one step back to what we already talked about with the granular lesson objective and in real time, making sure that everybody in a binary way can do that one thing for that day, you're not going to get out to the summative unit assessment and see that 50% didn't do it. Because every single one of those 10 lessons before the summative paragraph assessment is going to be directly aligned to writing that great paragraph. And you're already going to have great paragraphs at the end. because every day I've mastered topic sentence. I've mastered this. And by the time I write that great paragraph, my kids are going to be there. But if I give that summative assessment and they're not there, then what do I need to do as a teacher? I need to look back at my plan and those 10 lessons and reteach those things in a different way, find out the deficiencies that exist, and get all 10 of those kids there.
And let's say that they're still not doing well or as well as others. We still continue to practice writing the perfect paragraph all year long. We're never, ever going to let that skill or concept go. It's always going to be in the practice box, always. But moving on without children, that is not what's good for kids. I would say that people that make statements that are saying like, well, I can't dwell on this forever, we need to move on, that's a statement for the adult, not for the kids. That makes the adult more comfortable, because I can guarantee it's not what's good for kids. So I'm not saying that any of this is easy. This is not easy. This is very difficult. This is very time consuming. This is hard work.
Super hard. Super hard. This is the hard work. And this is where this idea, the need for a helpline on this comes from.
Yeah.
It is not easy. If it were easy, we wouldn't need to talk about it at all.
That's but the easy solutions. Of the podcast.
Right. Mike, the easy solutions are to say 70% of them have done okay on this. We're going to move on to the next thing.
Yeah.
And where both of us are, I know this for a fact, we're not okay with 70% being okay. I'm not okay with 100% being okay. I want 100% to have mastered it. And I know people are still going to listen and say, ah, but this kid and this kid and this kid. Okay, there are individual solutions for that kid and that kid and that kid, because their life literally depends on being able to have mastered the skills that you're teaching.
And I'm the hokey guy in the background saying, I want all kids to go home and be like, Mom, Dad, I wrote this paragraph.
Yes.
That's my space.
Yes.
Anybody who knows me knows that's how I approach teaching and learning every day. I want every kid to go home and talk about what we did in class excitedly.
And that's where I want to lean into this a little bit more, Mike, because if I am just a teacher and I'm like, everybody's going to write my objective for the unit is all students will write a great descriptive paragraph. And I haven't answered the why for the 10 kids. Yes, I'm going to have 50% that are writing pretty good and 50% that are not, or whatever that is. If I don't have an awesome why, and I don't have my assessment is off, just write this nonsense paragraph about this and move on. My kids aren't cognitively engaged. My kids don't take ownership of their learning. They don't care. Make it real. You know, slow myself down so I don't get off on a big tangent.
Mm-hmm.
Make it a product and make it real. All 10 kids are going to write an awesome descriptive paragraph of the person who they love most. And then they're going to give that to them in a card that we make with art that you make in art class of the things that represents them. And that is going to be a beautiful card that you get to give to this person who you love. And your paragraph has to be awesome so that they know how awesome they are and how much you love them. How much different is that than just write a descriptive?
Right. You're spot on. You're absolutely spot on. And let's just move this forward a little bit for the sake of, I think that our listeners are getting the idea right now, but let's move this forward to an end of year assessment, a state standardized assessment. All right, we've done all these things. I've grabbed kids with a hook. I've got my objectives on the board. I'm making real-time interventions with things that are in my pocket. I'm bringing kids up to the now. I'm creating meaningful experiences for kids that they can relate to. They're making cards for their parents. They're engaging in what their learning is. They're defending it against objectives. they're excited to be in class. And man, my standardized test scores are off. One, I'd be a little bit surprised. Two, if they're still off, we now have a separate curiosity as educators. I am now going to go backward and again, pair up what I'm doing with what other people are doing that maybe have seen the same result, seen a different result. Whatever that is, I'm always going to look to change my practice based on this, not to blame it on any outside scenario. Well, this group of kids, well, I remember that this happened. No. There is no such thing as this group of kids. If I use that term, I'm going to say that in a positive light. Boy, this is a really nice group of kids because I set this up for them, because we all worked hard to create scenarios where they are a great group of kids. I need to look back at some of the other things that happened. Were my lessons aligned to the standards or progressions that that test was testing? Did I look at eligible content just for this year's test? Were things aligned to that? Can I concretely point that kids demonstrated mastery of those objectives by the end of the year? And did I practice the output? I'm going to keep going back to this. Did I practice the exact output that was required of them at the end of the year on that standardized test? Did I set them up for that? Did I not oversell it so that they buck against it? Did I not undersell it so that they weren't ready for it? A lot goes into that. Those are big curiosities that I like to think about even as a principal. What did that environment look like in order to produce an output? Were they ready for it? And that's not going to be solved overnight. That's a long-term curiosity.
And something that's sometimes hard for teachers to do, it was hard for me to do when I was teaching sometimes, is to be willing to admit that there are things that you can improve upon, right? It is so easy for everybody to identify this as the reason why my scores aren't the way I want them to be for my students, or this, or this, or this, or this. But would you be willing to go to your building principal and say, what teacher in this building has the highest test scores?
Right.
Could I ask you an honest question, principal? What are they doing that I'm not? Mm-hmm. Could I go talk with them? Could I go observe them for a couple days? Can I get in their space to add to what I'm doing? Not even for me, but so that my kids are learning at a higher level. Because I guarantee you that there is a teacher in your space, probably, that is doing this at a great level, right? Mm-hmm. So what can I learn from them? Or if that doesn't exist, what could I learn from a teacher at a different building? Or what can I learn from listening to two guys on a podcast to help me do this, right? I got to look in the mirror and I've got to say I'm taking extreme ownership of this. And I am not willing to say that I am less than compared to other teachers. And I'm not willing to say that this group of 20 kids is less than the kids going to school in that school up the road. We are great, and I am going to have this score prove to everybody how great we all are. And I can't say my kids don't care about the test. What's that saying about me? My kids didn't try. What's that saying about me?
So let me give a concrete example that leads exactly right along with what you're saying. I'm going to give a very concrete example. Oftentimes, we might be doing things in the classroom that we don't see as having a negative effect. Now, here's something that I observed. This was a couple of years ago. We use what's called a cadence testing for our reading assessment. Okay, it's a very popular assessment to assess reading skills. So if you're an elementary listener, you know exactly what I'm talking about. But it's a larger standardized assessment. It's norm referenced against all kids in the country that do the same thing. So we have outside evaluators. We have Title I instructors, Title I specialists that will assess all of our kids with this Acadians test. All right, put that off to the side. Now, in the classroom, we are going to teach skills that directly align with the Acadians measure. So our kids are going to benchmark on this Acadians test, and we're going to teach toward that benchmark. I have a classroom, and the teacher's in front of the classroom, and they're doing a end of unit assessment really quick. And the teacher has to say a bunch of words, and the kids have to write them out. They're going to have to do this again on the Acadians assessment. The teacher says, word number one, should. Everybody write that down. All right, number one is should. Listen to the sounds in the word, should. All right, write that down. Number two, the word is sugar. Sugar. Listen to that word. Write the word sugar. Now, I'm going to speed this up a little bit. Now they're going to benchmark for the Acadians assessment. The Title I instructor goes, write the word should. Number two, write the word sugar. There is a massive difference between the classroom scenario and the assessment scenario. And when I observed that, I immediately hooked onto that and said, hold on a second. There is a disconnect between an outside assessment and what's going on in the classroom. We are scaffolding, that is the term used for helping kids out during instruction in real time. We are scaffolding the entire class inadvertently when they're now going to be assessed. And then we're wondering why it shows that our kids are doing poorly on Acadians. That teacher had no idea that they were inadvertently scaffolding the entire lesson or the entire assessment. And then we went back and looked at instruction. Did the instruction lead kids to be able to write the word the first time? No, it didn't. So we scaffolded an entire lesson from the very get-go all the way up until the assessment that says there's no scaffolding. That's very concrete evidence of saying, I was curious about that. Let's take a peek. And that went from lesson design to unit design, to assessment design, and could eventually lead to a great gap by the time we PSSA in the state of Pennsylvania in third grade. So that one small little problem could have been a great problem, and we want to talk about those things. Be curious.
Yeah. And I think all of this comes down to, Mike, and sometimes this is a little hard. This is a hard topic to talk about sometimes in this really real way, because if you really want help with this, help my students aren't learning, it's got to come down to extreme ownership and looking in the mirror and saying, what things can I do differently to make this different, right? Because all of the other things that you're going to think of reasons why you are not in control of, you're only in control of what you're going to bring into that space and change. So if you want to change your students' learning, there is only one variable you are in control of. That is you and your leadership of that class and how you do it. You're not going to change. You're not going to change where that kid is going home to at night. Impossible to change. You're only in control of you, but do you have the ability to overcome whatever those perceived limitations are to get the achievement that you want? Yes, you do. And like we already said, the work is extremely hard, but it is possible. It is possible for sure.
And with that, I challenge every listener of this episode to tomorrow or the day after tomorrow, or the next time you step into your classroom, that you empower yourself with the confidence to go and ask a colleague or your principal or whoever it is that you find is an instructional master or is an instructional inspiration to come into your classroom and give you an honest critique of your instruction. Do that. Do that. Open the door. Seek somebody out. Don't wait for the principal to come in and give you that one yearly evaluation that says you're proficient in everything. Good job, you're here next year. No. Empower yourself to ask somebody to come in and look at what you're doing. Break that chain of saying, I'm going to close my door, and the best teacher that I have that teaches me how to instruct kids is myself. That only goes so far. All learning is social, so we've said.
Mm-hmm.
Make it that way. You mm-hmm. be that person.
And I guess the last thing I would say about this, and we could probably do 15 podcasts on this one topic. We really could. And we're kind of at the surface level right here. Is my best advice is if you're there, my kids aren't learning, stop making excuses, start building solutions, and find those solutions. And you're going to start, you know, I want to find a small victory here. I want to incorporate this one aspect into what I'm doing. And you're looking for solutions. Do not go the other way. That happens all too often. And that is making excuses for why not. Start celebrating and sharing with others how I do this, because I believe that it is possible.
Can't say it any better. Perfect. Perfect.
All right, Mike, is that it? Help my students start learning. We solved the problem.
Yeah. We dug into it a little bit for sure.
Yeah.
So, all right, until next time.
Okay, thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
You've been listening to School Is Out with Mike and Miles. Appreciate you being here. See you next time.